I don't know how to play, and I don't want to anyway. Need to delete this game and go back to another save. But my hard drive's fucked. Zero charisma, zero luck. I don't have any skills or the XP to fix my
Hello and welcome to the 18th episode of the National Institute for Gamer Review. I am DK.
I'm Lewis, and this episode is brought to you by the Club of Rome.
Excellent. Yes, today we are discussing Frostpunk, which is a somewhat niche indie title, but you know, it's funny. So I had like been dimly aware of its existence, and it seemed interesting, but I had never gotten around to playing it. And then you actually alerted me that it was free on the Epic Games Store not that long ago, maybe like a month or so, and maybe less even. And I was like, well, obviously I'm just going to click the thing to put it in my library. And then you were saying, oh, it's really good. We should play. We should do an episode. I'm like, okay, sure, I'll check it out. And I was instantly so hooked that at one point Mrs. DK came to me. She's like, what? What is this? I've never seen this before. And I said, it's a game about collapse. So it's quite telling the Club of Rome. For those of you out in Rio Rhinelander who maybe missed the reference, the Club of Rome is the organization that put out the graph of the graph, you know, the Doom Spaghetti graph. And yeah, I mean, this is it's a lot of things. It's an interesting. I mean, there's so much that's so interesting and so good about this game. One of the things being it's simultaneously about collapse in the sense of, you know, the setting is maybe we can launch into that a little bit, kind of Victorian, an alternate Victorian era thing. I mean, you can kind of tell from the title it's steampunk in a certain sense, but steampunk at the end of the world where there's some kind of global climate catastrophe and everything is freezing. I came into it assuming that there would be some gay shit about global warming, climate change, carbon dioxide stuff that may it seems that that's not actually first of all, it doesn't actually even matter. It all kind of happens in the background, and the game, at least in the main campaign, is explicit that they don't even really know what happened. Apparently there's some DLC that goes into it a little bit, but I haven't played that, although I will. But from what I understand, it's actually, they don't even go in that direction either. So that's good, I guess. And so anyway, yeah, on the one hand, it's like, okay, so the world is kind of ending. There's this, you know, everything is freezing, and we gotta establish a kind of critical, a new settlement that's going to be able to withstand this just total collapse. And then, of course, as soon as you make this settlement, it's, you know, instantly there's all these problems. And so you have to deal with conditions of extreme precarity and extreme danger in a very kind of Club for Growth, Doom Spaghetti kind of way. So Any of you who are interested in any of these, any of this stuff, collapse, graph, resource precarity, scarcity, you know, if you have any of those kind of interests, I really couldn't recommend this game highly enough, even just at that level, and there are other levels as well. But before we go more, did you have any initial observations or things you wanted to say?
Yes, this game has like no browns. Do you notice any of them?
No, that was actually one of the things on my list. Was
it's explicitly like you are the English expedition,
yes,
in a kind of very like, it's like a kind of an inverse of like the Race to the North Pole stuff,
right? Yeah, right.
Where
it's
Race to the North Pole to survive instead of Race to the North Pole to die.
Well, or to explore. But yes, I was actually into that, like the North and South Pole expeditions when I was. When I was younger, I was like super into the history of that because I found that just super cool. But yeah, it was just, you know, we just a very white, you know, Aryan thing to like What do you mean? Why am I going to the North Pole? Because it's there, you know.
You're playing like the English, the English expedition, and it's, you know, what eight? It's like either at 1900 or a little bit before.
It's definitely before the First World War, if that would have ever happened in this universe. Yeah. I actually want to make it a little bit explicit for our listeners, particularly those of you who haven't played the game yet. Which again, I cannot recommend this game strongly enough. Play it if you haven't. Each individual character. So you play the captain of the city. You are essentially, dictator. Although your powers aren't. Well, anyway, we'll get into that. But so you are kind of have a bird's eye view of the whole thing. You are managing primarily three different types of population. You have like what they call workers, which are essentially like, you know, median IQ type individuals. Engineers, which are your upper classes and higher IQ type. And sometimes you'll run into explicit people who are explicitly scientists. These are always in gameplay terms cashed out as quote engineers, even if they're, you know, they weren't necessarily, I mean, they might have been like, you know, astronomers or something, but they're going to be classified as engineers, and then you can stick them to work in a hospital. You can't have workers, you know, the working class working in a hospital. They're not high IQ enough is the vibe. And then children is the third major population group. And each, so you I finished my first playthrough, my playthrough of the main campaign with like about almost 600 survivors, 600 people living in my city. You like sort of, you start with some and then you, you know, locate more and people show up and, you know, things like this happen. But, and they're all individually, each individual character, each individual like labor person unit thing has a name. Not only do they have a name, they have a portrait. So if you want to see like who's in the infirmary at any one given time or who's working in the coal mines or whatever, you can like zoom in on the coal mine and see a list of names and click on the name and you see a portrait. And every single portrait is a white person. It's extremely refreshing.
Yes, and there's the other, like, you can also click on the image. Like, it's obviously, this is like kind of gushing over that a lot of games have in like the sim genre or the, but obviously all the people are, it's a polygonal person running around your city, and you can like click the individual person running from work or home or at their job. You know, you can like,
yeah, you follow them
every
around.
Every person is rendered and
yes,
doing actions.
Now, that said, this is maybe jumping ahead a little bit, but it may be worth mentioning this. I don't actually consider, I do have a few very slight gameplay criticisms, very, very minor. This is not a criticism, it's just an observation that, it's not one for one in terms of the representation of the in-game sim characters actions and like the main thing is your resource production. Like as soon as the workday starts, you'll see when the work, you have, you know, normal shifts and extended shifts. And then, you know, once you've unlocked the law, you can declare a law saying that you allow for emergency shifts, and then you can make emergency 24-hour shifts. The production will be constant during working hours, irrespective of whether like the model is there or not. They do take some time to show up, and they do take some time to like go and eat, and they do take some time to, you know, when they're sick or some, you know, if you, it's typically you would have a cemetery, then you can have funerals, and then, you know, you when people die, you lose less hope. There's two main kind of like social meter resources, or hope and discontent. You want obviously a lot of hope and a little bit of discontent, or none. And when people die, you lose hope, but you lose less hope if you have a funeral. But when you have a funeral, people are off work, is you know, the gist of that. And yeah, there's not a one-to-one correspondence, but I mean who cares? Like, you know, it's minor, but it did kind of, it stuck out at me because that was sort of like, I think, a sop. I mean, I'm sure it's also harder to program, but something that makes the game a very unforgiving, brutal, difficult game, somewhat not as difficult to play.
Also, I will say, if you're going to play it, one thing I wanted to get in before we start, because I think we're getting some spoilers. I guess this is the point, hey, maybe stop. But like, but for your first playthrough, definitely don't look at a wiki or a gameplay guide.
Yes.
Definitely discover everything, because some stuff happened to me that I like discovered, and it really like not as it made impact on me, but it was a very cool, very.
I had a similar experience. It might have been a similar experience to you. I mean, yeah, we can compare notes in a second. I will say, normally, you know, I think our take on things, you know, is generally like spoiler. The concept of a spoiler is stupid and gay. I still maintain that, but in this case, because of the nature of the experience, it does benefit from like having certain things just like be a. I mean, I felt the same way, honestly, about Dark Souls, to kind of change gears for just 30 seconds. Like, I got in this bad loop with Dark Souls where I was just like, didn't understand why something was working. So I looked it up in the Wikipedia. I was like, I'll just look for a second. And then in the process of that, I was like, wait a second, there's all these other systems I had no idea existed. So I ended up sort of playing the Dark Souls with like one eye on the wiki the whole time, which is not the way to play Dark Souls. And I regretted that. We'll discuss that more when we talk about Dark Souls. But I think it's a similar thing going on here. It's not even so much, it's not that there's like narratively or plot wise, you know, spoilers like, oh no, oh my god, you know, Snape kills Dumbledore. It's not like that. It's more like
explicitly gameplay. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's gameplay in a game where one of the many cool things about this game, but I think the coolest, is it's basically a fascist dictator simulator. And it's completely unapologetic. Well, except for, I guess, put an asterisk in that. They try to maybe pull a little bit of the punches, you know, at the very, very end in the epilogue, if you make it that far. But, but basically, it's an unapologetic fascist dictator simulator. And the thing is, like, if you role play, as I kind of, you know, you get in a flow state where you're sort of role playing and you're, you know, you're invested and everything's clicking and you're like, you know, I am the fascist dictator of this city on the edge of oblivion, you know, freezing to death slowly and trying to prevent that from happening. The choices that you're presented with and the decisions you have to make and the trade-offs you have to make, it all works very well. It's all very affecting. And yeah, some of the stuff that happens, you know, midway and late into the game, I'm very glad that I didn't even really feel there was one or two points where there was some UI stuff. Again, one of these kind of very minor criticisms where it was like, basically I couldn't figure out, like, one of the things is you have to build roads. You have to connect your generator to your different things by roads. And I couldn't figure out how to like get rid of roads. You know, so I had to like look, I was like, I don't understand where this is in the UI. So I had to look that up. And there was one or two other little minor new UI hiccups like that. I guess the rest of this discussion is going to be full of like those kinds of gameplay spoilers that'll, I don't know, ruin the experience, but
if or you change haven't it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And not for the better, definitely for the worse. You know, maybe pause here and come back after if you've played at least one, you know, main campaign. All right. So with that having said, what was your big thing?
So I am kind of a softie at heart, and I didn't like play the game. Like, to normally, as a, if you know these kind of games that have like a morality system, you're supposed to just like hard run one way or the other way to kind of min-max things. And I didn't. One thing I actually like is that, to take a little sidebar, is the game will like, I think it knows most people are kind of soft and kind of tries to like seduce you into taking some of the bad things. Like, initially, when you first get on ground in the new area, you have to like just gather. You're just gathering materials. The jobs aren't very dangerous. They don't look dangerous.
Right.
And it says, hey, do you want to like put these kids to work? They're just picking up wood. No big deal. And it's a very strong case that, sure, why shouldn't these kids help pick up wood?
Well, I actually have a note on this before we continue, because that was one of my, like, yeah, I actually don't like they openly suggest, why don't you have kids working? And especially in that early days where you don't have any industrial processes, you need the labor. And it's true, it's like the kids are not, I mean, they're just gathering wood. And I actually made a point of like throughout the game, like I never had the kid. There's a tech tree in terms of research you can get, you know, basically better everything, whatever you can, you know, all the different gameplay things. And then there's a kind of quasi-tech tree, which is this legal system that we were discussing, where certain laws unlock other laws. And then you tend to have to make a decision between sort of kind of, you know, harder or softer approaches in general. One of the harder approach things that you can do is once you've allowed children, initially children can't work at all. Once you allow children to work, then you can basically have them do dangerous jobs and then have them train as like full-on workers and do the most dangerous jobs, and engineers too. I never did that, and I made a point of only ever sticking, just for essentially, you know, like kind of fascist dictator simulator LARPy type reasons, where the fun of these kinds of games is often, you know, just like, you know, what you do that the game allows for that isn't necessarily mechanically rewarded. Fairly early on, you get hothouses, right? And cookhouses, where you get these hothouses to grow plants, and then you cook them into food. These are basically the comfiest, least dangerous jobs in your city, because there's like a certain amount of warmth that, like, a hothouse has to be kept in a certain amount of warm in order to be able to function, and so they're never going to get at risk from falling ill to the cold. It's very, you know, it's not like they're working in a coal mine or a sawmill or whatever. So that's where that's the only place I would ever put child laborers is in positions like that. And the game at the end was like, we put our children to work and children died. Now I don't remember a child dying from workplace related accidents. It might have happened. I do remember the very first time that I put an emergency shift in, the game instantly smacks you. It's like, oh well, one of your, you know, you put these people to work emergency shift, well, one of them died from exhaustion, you know, fuck you. And I was like, okay, well, you know, sucks for him, but it kind of had to be done. I vaguely remember there might have been something like that with the very first time that you put a child to work. But
they
basically,
brick and arm or some bullshit.
Yeah, but so it's just like, I mean, it's just, it doesn't even really, like, I don't know. It was, yeah. Anyway, so, but yeah, the child labor thing was one of the things I was like, obviously, in this kind of a situation, you're going to have your kids, like, yes, I'm not going to, like, send them into the coal mines, but they can gather wood, they can cook meals, that's fine, you know?
So, my first playthrough, you know how much of a softy I am, this maybe comes back to bite me later, is that I said, we'll build the shelter. We're doing the Oliver Twist thing. You build like a, you know, like a, you know, old school, like an orphanage, and you have them just do whatever they do there. And I was very, very, I was very soft, I think, the first time I played it. But this was what came back to the big moment of it game being very cool, is that I was pretty soft, and, you know, there's a rational reason not to have kids work. You get a constant negative modifier if they do, for one. For, like, just, I think, hope or discontent. It's, like, a controversial law modifier, which I avoided the first time I played it. But I never really went too hard down. And then there's another, like, later tech tree is between, like, order and, like, what, theocracy or order and faith.
Yes, which is something else we should talk about in more detail later. Yeah, basically, just, you can be, like, Hitler or the, you know, the I don't know, the Pope. Who's a theocrat? Dalai Lama. You know what I mean? It's sort of like...
Yeah, you can be a...
You can be a secular dictator or a theocratic dictator, essentially.
Basically, yes. And they're very similar in how the game treats them. But anyway, so I kind of just chose, like, vaguely around the dictator path, the secular path, but not, like, hard enough. In the whole game, you're kind of preparing for, like, the big freeze, which is basically the winter. The whole game is Arcus. You're preparing for winter. And but when winter hit, I hadn't fully done my dictator tech tree because I didn't feel the need to do it. And the winter being, it's very, you know, so this is the big spoiler coming in. It's
so like the game starts and like things are bad, but they're not necessarily the worst. And you have some. Go on.
It's like spring or summer, but in this world, it's just cold because the world is cooling.
Yeah, well, there's some kind of, like, basically there's some kind of big storm. You don't learn, this is like one of the, there's two big gameplay twists, essentially. One is about halfway through the campaign or so, you either discover or someone from a doom, you are kind of just, you're, the setting here is like, England is doomed, and there's like a bunch of English people who have made their way to the North Pole is sort of, or the, you know, whatever they call it, Frostland. It's kind of, I guess, like, you know, the Arctic has frozen over and become solid or whatever. So there are a bunch of, there are several different settlements. The pride of place, the most important one, is this military scientific establishment called Winterhome, which was like the kind of intended by the British government. Seems is the kind of vibe you get of like, this is our best shot. But you discover that Winterhome has collapsed into anarchy and poor planning and civil war.
Very like a Roanoke type thing, yeah.
Yes, exactly. So that causes basically everyone in your settlement to lose all their hope. They're like, if they couldn't make it, we don't have a chance. And so there's so you're called New London because, you know, you all fled from London, which is collapsing. They're like, well, why? There's a segment of your population that's like, well, why don't we go back to London? And you basically have a variety of tools. That's the point where managing these what were they called, the returners or something, I don't remember what they're called, but basically the
Londoners.
Thank you. They're like, oh, the people who want to go back to London, and they try to convince, you know, your population. So you have to like manage this problem. This is where the secular versus theocratic dictator tree opens up, and those trees give you a lot of abilities and tools to manage the Londoners specifically. So when the basically that you know, with you're typically not, I mean, I didn't have too much trouble putting it down over time. I used the tools at my disposal, which we'll talk more about later. And then like as you're about, you know, actually just it was they pace it very well, I felt. Just as everything's starting to really click and it seems like, you know, you have a good resource flow, you're able to stockpile, you're able to continue growing, you know, everything's going well, then you get word that there's this enormous storm coming, like the winter that you refer to. I don't think it's like the season winter, it's like some kind of just enormous, just like, you know, like the kind of storms you see on Jupiter except on Earth, right? And so there's basically, they're like, look, it's coming in not that long, and we have to prepare and do everything we can to survive. And it's going to be, you know, much colder and harsher conditions than anything we faced for longer than any amount of time that we've faced. I have something that I want to add to that, but first I want to let you continue your thing.
So I was in the depths of it, and it does, like, gameplay-wise, go on, like, long, and it makes it more satisfying to do, but while you're doing it, like, you're really sucking, and more disasters happen during it that you have to deal with, and I started dealing with like a massive, you know, there's lots of issues happening, lots of complaints are made, and you have to like address them.
Well, the big,
and they're much harder, and they're harder to address because of the conditions,
exactly.
Right?
The big thing is also like, so there's several resources. The main there's coal, which is mainly used for heating, wood and steel, which are mainly used for building, and then steam cores, which is like steampunk fantasy LARP. Stuff about basically just for advanced technologies.
Well, they're basically effectively they're engines.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah.
So the thing is, you need coal to heat. Without coal, you know, your generator doesn't produce heat, and the more heat it produces, the more coal it burns, and you can set, you know, with tech upgrades, you know, how hot it burns and how far out that heat goes. The one of the things that happens, which I actually was like, so while I was so going into the storm, I sort of like, I was prioritizing. I was like, okay, well, what is going to happen is I need to have everybody stay home as much as they can. One of the things that the game has is very steampunkish, but also I think steampunk is overplayed and kind of sucks generally, but this game is not offensive. I think it does it pretty well.
It's like Tesla. There's like some Tesla.
Yes. Well, Tesla's a character. He's a name. There's a city called Tesla City, and Tesla himself he's off screen the whole time, but he's a named character. Anyway, so you get these automatons. You get these basically giant robots that can do the work of a whole team in a coal mine, or a whole team in, well, any building, basically, especially once they've been upgraded. So it's like, okay, well, what do I want to do when the storm hits? And I never bought, that was one of my key mistakes, but I mean, you sort of make sense. They're like, okay, well, we should research the storm so we know more about it, like how long it's going to last. I'm like, I don't need to know how long this is going to last. Like, I know it's going to last a long time. I'm going to prioritize researching other stuff so that I can get everything the way that I want it to be, you know, under kind of horrible conditions, to where at least everybody is going to be in a well-insulated fully insulated house, close enough to the generator so that the generator is burning and producing enough heat for everybody. And that during this time, because, you know, it's going to be burning through a lot of coal, I want my coal mining operations to be entirely automated and run by these automatons so that, like, I don't have to send human, you know, coal mining teams. I can just, like, the humans can stay in their houses and the machines can go mine the coal. Well, thing number one that that happened was that the coal mines collapsed. And so you're faced with a choice between basically you got to go send up to 45 people to go and prevent the coal mines from collapsing, and every single one of them dies. If you want your coal mines, you get up to 3 coal mines in your little, you know, crater in the ground, and if you want the coal mines to continue producing coal, then you have to sacrifice 45 people. I had actually managed to stockpile enough coal. I played it out both ways because I was sort of wanted to, you know, LARP it one way and then the other way, but I'd actually stockpiled more than enough coal to make it through at full burning capacity without having to do that. But it was just kind of funny that I, you know, and I don't think the game warns you about that. It did warn you about the other thing that happens, which I was actually a little bit pissed about, but in a good way. Because I was like, okay, the other big thing I wanted to do was have a fully automated food production. And have, you know, have everything, several hothouses, all industrial, all automated, all run by machines, so that, again, everybody could stay home and they have enough heat and enough food to make it through however long. Well, when the storm hits, the ground freezes over, and you can no longer, I anticipated that I wouldn't be able, there's two main sources of food, is you can set out traps or go hunting, which requires a lot of workers to go do that. And the other thing is these hothouses and you're growing food. I anticipated that in the conditions of the winter of this massive storm that they wouldn't be able to go out and hunt. So I was like, okay, well then I'll just focus on hothouses. I did not anticipate that the hothouses, the soil in the hothouses was frozen over. So I had barely enough food. I had like sort of not really prioritized it, but I had been stockpiling a little bit of food. And by the end of the storm, like people were starving, like a quarter of my population was starving, but nobody had died from starvation or anything. I had just enough food to make it through. But it was a very cool moment of like, oh shit, I didn't do the research. I didn't quite know that this particular thing was going to happen, which if you, on a second kind of, I had a save game. I wasn't save scumming, but I would occasionally. There were a few little things that I wasn't like, with these little UI things or things that weren't clear, I would save every so often just to kind of have a point back if there was something that and I definitely wouldn't recommend save scumming. But anyway, I had a save game that was like, you know, a couple, like 1 or 2 days before the storm with just enough time to research the storm. And indeed, if you do that, then it gives you a little heads up that you're not going to be able to use the hothouses either. So I was like, okay, well, that there you go. But yeah, it was just a cool kind of gameplay moment of like, shit, this one thing that I didn't anticipate like nearly wrecked us. But fortunately, I was like just good enough at stockpiling food that we made it through.
So my big moment is that I'm probably not as good at this kind of game as you are, because I was very much like kind of making it past like certain like disasters even before the storm hits by the skin of my teeth, probably because I didn't min-max hard enough in one way. I was doing a very like, you know, humanitarian type benevolent fascist leader
gay, and
I was getting absolutely you know, doing all right, and then when the storm hits I started getting absolutely wrecked with all these events, and you know, so there's a point within the tree, and I started have to using being more oppressive on the secular dictator path to just contain these things. I was losing people left and right, and I eventually at some point because I had to be more oppressive, I finished the dictator tech tree, like the secular one, and it hits you with the bonus, which is, fuck yeah, you've achieved full fascism.
Yeah, right, exactly.
Hope and discontent no longer matter.
Right.
And it was, but it hit like midway through the storm, and effectively bailed me out, because everyone was so on board with the fascist project that they could just starve, and they would shut the fuck up about it and be happy.
Right.
And like had I not hit that, I would have lost the game.
You would have lost the game. That's awesome.
So yes. I hit, and that like bailed me out, and I was like, okay, well, it's a lot, because you end up limping through the storm no matter how good you are to a degree, and it made limping through the storm so much easier when you're not like, oh, I lost a guy, well, you know, just keep on trucking. And it, yeah. So that was how I played it.
That's,
so it,
that's the game really does, great. Yes. Yeah. I think it's only one of the meters that no longer, and then it replaces it with something else, but it's basically like, yeah, one.
Well, it replaces it with like, it can't decay.
Right.
Past a certain point.
Yes.
And it was enough for me that I
in
could,
in that situation.
I think,
yeah.
Yeah. And that I could definitely push through it.
Yeah, that's really fun. That's really cool. That's one of those cool like emergent moments that I think the best game, the games that are the most memorable in my experience, it's not always, you know, sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't, but you always, you know, the reason why I think people, that's why people play Paradox games too, right, is these kind of emergent moments like that where the system just allows for something that was just just like it just works great and it feels awesome. Yeah, I went the theocrat route. My LARP was more like, I was like, I'm going to be maximally humanitarian until the point where I can foresee that it's going to cause problems. Which is why I was like, children can work, but they're not going to work unless I need them to. I'm not going to, you know, force them into the coal mine. Or and that was the other thing that was like, and this is what sort of the game punishes you for in a really weird way in the epilogue. Was like so and I think this exists on both trees, just they're just called different things. Basically during the Londoner saga portion of the thing, but also just in general, obviously order breaks down and people, you know, like the more desperate things get, the more people are inclined to, you know, steal or stockpile for themselves or, you know, do various things that go against the collective interest. So you are presented with the possibility, which I immediately took because it was just a no-brainer, of forming essentially a police force. They're called the Faith Watchers if you're the if you go the theocrat route. I don't know what they're called if you go the secular route. But essentially,
they're
now
like it's like the Town Watch, I think, is my bet.
Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, that's basically what it is. It's basically just like this is the, you know, we're now a settlement of several hundred people. We're having different kinds of issues where people are, you know, behaving in ways they shouldn't. And in addition to like just kind of certain amounts of general social unrest and things like that. And we need enforcers. And this is just a very basic thing. I mean, I don't know like what, and I don't know if it's like some kind of weird libertarian priors or what exactly, but, I just took it as sort of like, I mean, to me, having some kind of police force or town watch is, I mean, just
it's some kind of special service.
Well, that's I guess the line that
and they really do dress it up like if you go you took the theocracy route, which I think, yeah, is a little less. There are red banners everywhere.
Nice.
And it so
I'll have
unfortunately
to do it that way
me,
next time,
my
yeah.
priors didn't get like set off by this because I don't have those are gone. It's like
you're like this is cool. Yeah.
If City Hall has a red banner now, it's like, and it's
fuck
like a
yeah.
black triangle. It's like a black triangle or something like that. Like
yeah.
Okay. Yeah, we're doing this. Like,
<you're> like but it's like no, that's supposed to be bad. I mean, it does, but that's the thing is like, you know, people talk. It's one of these fancy words that I see in publications that I hate, but. It's a good word nonetheless, is ludonarrative dissonance of like the game doesn't finger wag about like, okay, well we have, you know, Gestapo now. In mechanical terms, in fact, it rewards you like straight up, just doesn't even, it's an enormous benefit with basically no downside. And then after you make it through the storm, it's like, we had, you know, faith. In my case, it was like faith was abused. We made, you know, violent public penance, and, you know, people beat each other. You know, you had violent enforcers who were beating people up. It's like, yeah, that's what it takes. What is wrong with you? Like, I can't imagine finger wagging like that after the fact. I guess that when we were talking before the show, and I was like, I don't understand how this game got made. And I guess that's kind of like part of the answer was like, you know, they sort of rationalized it. They made this amazing fascist dictator simulator that, among other things, and maybe this is a good place to make this point, it really does an excellent job of showing, of making you understand viscerally how liberalism, neoliberalism, human rights, all that bullshit is just, it's completely decadent and completely parasitic upon conditions of material excess and the temporary banishment of scarcity and precarity. As soon as you reintroduce conditions of material scarcity, as soon as you reintroduce conditions of, you know, survival isn't just something to be taken for granted. Instantly, it's like, oh yeah, well, we need fascism. Instantly, overnight, literally overnight. In the case, I mean, and I mean, you could say like, oh well, it's just a video game. It's like, okay, yeah, but I mean, it's striking at something true, and it's really making you understand. You know, obviously you could, you know, make a gay luxury space communism simulator game and set all the resources to infinite and, you know, obviously, I mean, but that's not how the world works, right?
Yeah.
And
so which brings me back to one of my favorite campaign, the main campaign is one, it's great. They're all great. All the campaigns are really great their own way. My favorite main campaign is once you unlock the first campaign, you unlock more, and there is DLC, I think, but I didn't end up playing it either. But I will at some point.
I will. I'm on a roll now. Sure. I'm just enjoying the shit out of this game.
So there's the science campaign, and I'm not spoiling it, I don't think, when I tell you this.
There's not really any spoilers to be... Oh, sorry,
so
go on.
It very much
I finished.
That.
I did that one. I did. It's called The Arcs, and it's a really cool scenario. And
it's much shorter too, which is.
It came up in several reviews, and I think I can see why. I played it first. I'm kind of wishing I hadn't, because I think it's clearly the strongest of the DLC, the scenarios that come with the game. There's these DLC scenarios that have, you know, some seem better than others also, but yeah, this one is really, really good too, and I did manage to make it through.
Yeah, so it teases that, hey, this is like basically the enlightened libtards with all these machines, all these automatons, and, you know, you're going to create this kind of utopia where nobody works in theory, you know, or, you know, middle
kind
work.
Of, yeah, almost.
And or it's teasing that, hey, you'll be able to automate everything, bro, and right. You just can't. It's no, you know, very much no.
Right.
In fact, if you even try to think about that, you're going to get just fucked. And also, I believe you still end up going down the theocracy or
you order still path. you have a limited theocracy.
It's a shorter
yeah,
and because you still have to end up doing that stuff.
Of course you do, because there's no way around it in human societies.
What's also funny in terms of libtard priors or libertarian priors, I don't know how you phrase it.
Libtards are libertarians. I don't really liberals are just liberals, you know. But anyway,
so
sorry,
the
go
first
on.
Step. So you talk about at one point in the faith tree that you took, you end up doing like. Cops, basically the cop part.
Yes.
So the first, the first step of the order tree, is like cops, and like the implication being like having police at all, is what leads to all the fascism.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, the very idea.
The concept,
of, like,
yeah, right.
Whereas with the faith tree, it's like having a church.
Yes, that's the first thing that you the first, and that was actually one of the reasons why I went that. It wasn't the only. I mean, it was more like, again, I was LARPing as like a mostly benevolent but hard-headed fascist dictator who is like, for example, like I was perfectly happy to take survivors as many, and anytime I saw survivors, I would always make a point of escorting them back to my city rather than continuing to search for more resources, because they could die if you didn't en route, you know, back to your place if they tried to make it on their own. So I was like, no, we'll escort you. I always took survivors, you know, no exceptions. And anytime there's actually one point, it's like a more minor event, but you get hit by several waves of refugees who were increasingly sick. And, you know, like, with really grave illnesses.
But racially, they're not sick.
Exactly. They're all white, yes. Anyway.
I did the same thing. I did the same thing. Just instant take them in.
Instantly took them all in, and then I just dealt with it and created them all to the best of my ability. And actually, I think pretty much very, very few deaths. I had a pretty good operation. But then.
I think that. Yeah. Well, did you do. So, you kind of take up. There's two tech trees of healing. One is like radical healing, and one is like hospice.
I always did. I did hospice from the start. That was one of my first decisions. Yeah.
I was interested. This is what I want to ask, because I always did radical because, you know, leading edge here, and I was on the assumption that event was supposed to fuck you if you chose hospice, because they wouldn't. They would just like fill your hospital with like terminally ill people, and you would.
Well, by that point, I had researched, because you can heal gravely ill people if you go far enough down the essentially the medical part of the tech tree. And I was always like, look, we're going to try to save everyone we can. I know I'm not going to be able to save everyone, but I'm going to make a good faith effort. And I kept people in palliative care for a long, long time. They eventually started dying before most of the initial people who got gravely ill died eventually of natural causes before I was able to upgrade myself to the point where I could heal them. But then I made it sure to get, I tried my best. And then by the time all those very gravely ill refugees came, I had the tech, I had everything ready to go. It just had to, like, I had to scale up with like a few more medical facilities. Other than that, I was able to heal pretty much everyone. And that was one of my early, that was what I was like, I'm going to try to do this as, you know, I wouldn't even say humanitarian, just, you know, benevolently as possible, up to the point where I start, like, foreseeing that there's going to be big problems, it's not going to be possible, and then I'm going to take more radical action. Unfortunately, one thing, I'm going to try to play it also on a harder difficulty, because that was some of the thing, I found it, you know, towards the very end, I think I was able to stockpile, like, 25,000 coal or something, where you only need, like, 5,000 to make it through, or 6,000 to make it through the winter storm. I lost my train of thought. The refugees, yeah. So I took in everyone, and then at the very end, where it's like the storm is coming, and we have a certain number of people, which means a certain number of mouths to feed. And this is before I was aware that there was going to be this issue with food. I was like, you know, you run into some, you know, like last dregs and people who are just gravely ill, probably not even going to make it anyway, and you already have too many mouths to feed and not enough coal or whatever. And I'm like, you know, I just made a choice. I was like, you know what, I've taken in everybody up to this point, but we can't afford to take in more at this moment in time, you know, sorry. Was another kind of interesting role play moment for me.
Yeah. Did you also do like the refugees campaign?
No, that put me off.
It's weird because it's a sub campaign of the main campaign, kind of.
I'm gonna play through. I think I want to play through all the scenarios just to kind of. I mean, I like the gameplay. I like the setting. I like everything about it. When I like was first kind of poking around the menu, I saw that and I was instantly like, oh god, this looks gay as fuck. Like, this is the one gay thing about this. It's not. I looked in the Wikipedia.
But it's not.
I looked at the, like, just a little bit of the description in the wiki. I was like, oh, it's not about that at all. Okay, never mind.
No, it's definitely, like, there's obviously, like, some commie stuff to it. Sure,
yeah.
But it ends up being more fascist.
I thought it was going to be, I thought it was going to be, like Angela Merkel 2015 simulator. And I was like, but that's not what it is at all. Yeah.
No, we can just kind of give away. It's that you play, like, the... a very small, like a tiny city that is a breakaway, like, it's like the communist English or unionist, kind of trade unionist.
I mean, think Goyish labor organizers around the very late 1800s.
Yeah, so it's, or I guess you call it utopians, maybe even you could call them, if more Eric.
Yeah, utopian socialists in like the Fournier mold, yes.
Yeah, and so you have your own, it's a very small city, and it's kind of, or it's kind of explicitly smaller. You only have like 20 workers and 8 engineers starting off, and so there's refugees come, and your kind of commune swells in you know, worker power, and it's kind of easy early on, and then you get the follow up wave of refugees after the initial one or two, and they all those refugees kind of make you. They all kind of pretty. Basically make you stronger because your population is low. It's a it's waves of lords, like aristocrats come after their expedition, after the aristo, like the monarchist reactionary one fails, after their and it's implied it fails because they're all fucking, you know, aristocrats. And then you deal with waves of, like, you know, lords, and they're called the lords. They're like the aristocrat faction, and they come. And the other thing is, if you don't let them in, they will. So you can let them in and try to, like, deal with that class conflict and try to beat them down or whatever. Or you can say, like, fuck you, you can't come into my city. It will form a enemy city right outside your city. And you have to deal with that, which is actually harder to deal with than the actual just...
I can imagine.
Yeah, it's really good. It's very different. Like, basically, the science scenario is kind of like... It's like the inverse of the science scenario where you're just overrun with manpower. You have all the manpower you could ever need.
Yeah, that was one thing about the so the scientist scenario that we mentioned before is basically you're scientists who are charged with making a completely autonomous facility that will indefinitely care for seeds taken from around the world so that they can survive this climate catastrophe and, you know, eventually be replanted and repopulate the earth, hopefully. And so you start with like 45 scientists, and I was actually in the main campaign. I actually figured out a kind of hack where basically I built two research facilities, workshops, they're called, and I would always have one or the other on a 24, because you can only do emergency shifts like every so often, basically once every 2 days or so. But if you have two facilities, then you can just constantly have one of them under emergency shift. And every so often, someone will die, an engineer will die from the emergency shift. But if you have a city, you have a population of like 500, 600 people with several hundred engineers, like, and actually by the end, I was mostly, you know, a lot of people were unemployed, had a lot of spare labor. That's fine. Okay. I need the research more than I need the, you know, one or two people who are going to die every couple of days. But with the scientists, but you have so little manpower and it's never replenished that's not possible, right? It's a really serious issue. So I was much more careful with my manpower in that situation.
Yeah, no, all scenarios, I think, put a good twist on the mechanics.
The one that I found the most frustrating, this is what I'm doing now, which I was trying it on the hard difficulty setting, is the Fall of Winterhome scenario, which is basically in the aftermath of it's sort of taking place in, that we were talking about, this, you know, Winterhome settlement, which was supposed to be the main one. It was completely mismanaged, and when the scenario starts, the previous captain had just been executed, and there was a brief civil war, essentially, that led to huge parts of the city being burned down. So you have to kind of clear the rubble and figure out how you're going to manage that. And I found it just like extremely infuriating, because like the things that I would normally do that had worked in other scenarios just like don't apply in a lot of ways. And so I was just like, okay, well, this feels more like a puzzle than, you know, a puzzle game than a city simulator. So I don't know. We'll see how that goes. But yeah, all the scenarios are once you play the main campaign are quite good. Quite good.
The main campaign obviously I think is the heart of the game, but the sub scenarios are great. All the sub scenarios kind of like do their own kind of twist. Usually they'll make one thing easy and a lot of things much harder.
Yeah, so in that one, it's like the ruined buildings that you have to like manually tear down. You're also very limited in the number of engines, the steam cores that you can use to build advanced stuff. What else? There was anyway, the mechanics, I think, are less. I mean, you know, it's one of these things where if you've played it, you know, and if you haven't, hopefully you have played it now before listening. But yeah, it's I don't know what else. I'm trying to think of like if I had any other big picture points. Nothing off the top of my head.
There's a lot. I think it's interesting. Cause, like, I want to point out, like, the game is good, not because it. Like, it's really rewarded by its, like, doing a small-scale thing as opposed to doing a... Like, a lot of games get very ambitious, whereas Frostpunk is so great because it takes... It's, like, a very small game, and it perfects its world and its systems in a very, like, small way. It's not that it's, like, unambitious, but it's not... it's not pushing itself to do, like, more than what it is. It's really good. Reminds me of it's gonna be a weird comparison of like the first first episode we did. It was on the new XCOM reboot,
mm-hmm.
where it's just trying to do like get a distinct feel down and a distinct like gameplay loop down, and just doing that really well and iterating on it multiple times.
Yes.
Because that's really enjoyable. And it's not about being a huge world or even a lot of different options. You don't have a ton of freedom as a player. There's not really too many different ways to make a city work. There's kind of one platonic right. city that you're striving for the entire time.
Basically, yeah.
And but it works really well, you know? I think a lot of modern games are hurt by kind of endless ambition and also like endless budgets where they can pursue yes. that, where this is a kind of a cult classic, kind of a word of mouth, slow burn game that's, I think, very getting popular very slowly and has gained mass popularity. There's actually going to be, apparently, a very highly anticipated port to like modern Android devices.
Oh.
So that'll be very...
There's also, I saw a board game, which I think it could work really well as a board game. I saw that
is it like competitive or co-op? That'd be interesting.
I think it's yeah, that's an interesting question. I presume it's co-op and you're like fighting the elements. Maybe even, yeah, I don't know.
It'd be urgent, yeah.
But you could easily see it working well in that way.
Or even as like two factions in one city that like,
right.
if you overperformed too well, if you defeat the other person too much, you're fucked because they need to be there to help you. So you give them wins to a degree, but also beat them in points or whatever. Yeah, I can see you could do that. That board game would be very interesting on how you did it.
I'm curious how it turns out for sure. But I agree. I like the comparison to XCOM. I like it for the ways you mentioned, also the ways in which it really allows you to kind of get in the headspace of there was something that the original StarCraft did that was somewhat common for the time but really isn't so much anymore, which is that like when you get the mission briefings in StarCraft, you are the commander of the forces that you're deploying, and you get addressed by, you know, whoever is, you know, informing you on stuff, and they address it to like you, the player, as like you, the avatar of the you know, the person. That's a neat little kind of trick. I don't know that it works super great in StarCraft. It works okay, but not super great. There's nothing nearly so explicit in XCOM. Well, that's not true. That's not true, actually. No, what am I saying? They say you all the time in XCOM, and they say you all the time in this game as well. And so in between that and the gameplay systems and the possibilities for emergent gameplay and just the really just how well designed it is, if you allow yourself to feel immersed, it really does a very good job of drawing you in and creating this immersion that is really rewarding. I think because, you know, it's really striking at something true about the human condition, and the art's good. And I mean, you know, it clearly doesn't have the highest budget, but it doesn't need to. It just does everything so well. Even the writing I found was
the writing's great. Still a lot of little attention to detail, like how the shift starts at like 6 a.m. and it's dark out and everybody comes out with torches. So you can see the beginning of the day is the work day, is all your people going to work by torchlight, all in like a basic procession to work. And it's, you know, it's very aesthetic, obviously. It also helps you visualize like where your people are working at area wise.
Yep. Yeah, and city layout, we haven't talked so much about that, but laying out, you know, urban planning is a hugely important thing. I mean, there's always trade-offs and things you have to manage. And it, you know, of course, costs resources to connect stuff and to heat stuff, and you have to think about what makes sense for to be near each other. I found myself sort of, you know, because the game, when the game starts, it's like the conditions aren't necessarily that super horrible, but you know that they're going to get worse quickly, and you don't, you know, there's just a million fires. it's like your question of putting out fires, like the whole thing is on fire, and it's when your question of like what to prioritize, it's almost like the closest. It's like, how do I prioritize everything? It's like I can't, but I don't even know.
So speaking of that,
yeah.
This is where I want to get into where this game actually has some like deep insights on the fascism, which are like positives. In that, so usually there's like a, when the people come to like So you have your things you want to do, your fires you want to put out, in the like the things you want to stand up in the order you want to stand them up. But the people will come to you with their desires, right?
Yeah.
And you're usually given a three-part thing where you can just say no. You can just say no.
Right.
And you get a not actually that bad of a
typically it's hit. Not that bad a ding, yes.
Or you can say, hey, I will do this. So they'll come to you at the first one. They say, hey, we need, like, because you're trying to stand up, like, food and stuff. And the first thing that come to you, people say, hey, early on, we need, like, places to live. We want to prioritize that. And you can say, no, I'm just going to do it. I'll get around to that when I get around to it. Or you can say, I will do it, like, I will address this concern. Or you can say, like, I will fully and 100% address this concern.
Yes.
Which is, like, a big promise. And it's usually pretty hard to do. And this is kind of gets into how, like, if you talk about, like, to how in, like, in, like, a, you know, neoliberal democracy or really democracy, no one is in charge and therefore can be held accountable. Like, oh, the Democrats stopped me from building the wall. The Republicans stopped me from forgiving student loan debt. In a fascist society where there is one person in control, there is one person in control who can, you know, be petitioned and also also be held responsible. And Frostpunk is a game about responsibility. You're kind of, and it tells you early on, you are in charge of the morality of this town and every action that kind of goes on with it. And you're not responsible for, like, when people, like, do crime or whatever, it's not your fault. But, like, for instance, you can legalize prostitution or...
Yeah, I made sure to not do that. I was like, if I absolutely have to, but I never had to.
As opposed to beer, you know?
Yeah, right.
And that's, like, reflects good or poorly on you and how well you did. And stuff like that. So I think it makes a very strong case for fascism, in that, like, in you, that while the leader has like immense power, he has to listen to the people, has to. But if he needs to because he has more foresight or, you know, more XYZ, he can defy them, for the greater good up to a point, you know.
Yeah, no, it's, I was going to make a joke when you were saying that about, like, you know, what do you mean you can't just, you know, can't you just vote people out of office? Isn't that how our system works? Yeah.
The democracy is basically screwing you and saying it was your idea.
Yeah. One funny note about the prostitution bit. Yeah, so you can erect a tavern is one of the laws, and then you have to build it.
Oh, no, you're the English. You're the English. It is a public house.
Public house, because
you are the English expatriate, very specifically.
It's a public house. I'm trying to be, but yes. And then you can allow prostitution. Interestingly, which I found kind of hilarious, I was trying to imagine, I didn't sign the law, but in the scientist scenario, where, again, it's 45 people total, all of whom are, like, highly trained, highly educated scientists. You can sign the prostitution law. I'm like, okay, so who are the female scientists who are, like, prostituting themselves by night and working in the, you know, the drafting board by day? Like, it's just sort of a funny mental image there.
If you want to just really big brain it, you can say all of the scientists felt very good and progressive about legalizing prostitution, even though there were no prostitutes. They just got upcomings from it.
On that note, because you, like any other structure, you can go and see who's in the public house at any given time. In the main campaign, in the city with a bunch of laborers, the public house was always full. In the scientist campaign, when I ran, at least when I ran every single, I don't know if you know how, if it was just every single, but I clicked on the public house several points in the campaign. No one was ever in it. So
it's just the idea of it, you know. It does
right.
The idea of leisure does help you work harder, you know.
True, it could be. It's there if I want it to be.
Yeah,
but
I always did the moonshine pack. I'm not a
moonshine general. Is one of the. It's almost a hack. It's moonshine is like basically every time you get a meal, you get a little bit of discontent removed. Yeah. Which, like, because if people are well fed, then they're basically always getting discontent removed. So you're basically never getting discontented. Which is
great, because which is also, like, very accurate to the time, but with gin.
Yes.
Gin was like used to suppress lower classes content.
And vodka in Russia, right?
Yes. Although interestingly, like vodka was always like considered like a. If those of you have read the English translation online of 200 Years Together, vodka was always, or not vodka, whatever, we'll use it with moonshine more than vodka at the time, just because of the nature of certain things that were available. Vodka kind of comes later. But moonshine was, in Russia, it was run by our favorite friends with the noses. And these Israeli-Americans in Russia were using it to profit off the peasants, and the government was actively suppressing it, like trying to suppress it and trying to ban the process or profit off at certain points in Russia. But in Britain, it was very explicitly like a worker suppression thing. The British were very aware of like what gin was for, what they were using it for, in a way that I think it's almost kind of unique in European history that. It was explicitly designed as kind of an opiate of the masses, and it reflects, and the gameplay reflects that. Did I get lose you, GK?
No, I'm here, and yeah, it was. I mean,
and also, it's the other thing is that if you one other big mechanic is that there's two ways you can go, or three. Well, it was a third way, I guess. That's even worse. But early on, you're faced with two ways to stretch your food. One is basically food additives, which increase your rate of illness.
You're putting sawdust in your meals.
Yes. Additives. You know. additives. You know? It's like high fructose corn syrup, but less
yes.
so. Or you can just do soup, which basically makes people unhappy, but is healthy. And you can kind of neutralize the soup debuff with vodka, or moonshine.
Yeah, right. Well, the other thing about soup is that you make more of it from fewer raw ingredients. I actually never... There were a few points where I was running a little bit low on food, and I just dealt with it. Like, I never signed either of those laws.
Really? Oh, the soup one was always an easy gimme for me. Because morally it makes sense, you know. It's just soup. Like, also, you can un-soup. You're not always doing soup.
Yeah, that was one thing that I wasn't... So the laws in general... This was sort of an interesting thing that I think it makes a certain amount of sense, but and I can understand the gameplay reasons for it, but there's no respecking. Like, once you choose a law, that's it. It's enforced forever, and its negative or positive consequences are enforced forever. And sometimes you had a binary choice, like we mentioned earlier, kind of obliquely between radical treatment and sustained life is one of the most interesting and important and early choices. Is basically, you know, with radical treatment, if someone falls gravely ill before you have the technology to fix them, then you basically roll the dice, and sometimes they'll be healed, sometimes they'll be amputated, and
or die. I think they can
or die. Yeah, well, that's triage, which is that's basically even worse of a roll. Basically, like that, yeah. There, it's like you can instantly heal people, but a quarter of the people who are gravely ill will just die. And I never did that either. Yeah, so once you choose either radical treatment or sustained life is when you basically, if they're gravely ill, they won't die, but they're occupying beds until then. You get a further facility called a care house, which you can put, you know, people in palliative care and not take up hospital beds, which is what I did until I fully got the rest of the research for the infirmary where I could properly heal them. But it locks you in to a choice that you've made, and there is no way to unlock it and respec, which, like, especially for a first playthrough, is definitely a kind of an interesting vibe.
One thing that is kind of annoying is that I never did it because I have played it a couple times, but I get to the point. So let's say you do child labor, you get to a point where you don't really need it anymore. So you
exactly that was, but you still did it, yeah.
Yeah,
and it's still on the books. And then the game will punish you for it in the epilogue. And it's like, yeah. All right, but you know,
yeah,
yeah. The epilogue, I thought was.
Do you want to go just deep dive in the epilogue? Do a little deep dive into what the epilogue is and what. So the big thing for me, and I guess if you're listening to this show, you're probably playing it through a similar perspective of fascism being okay and, you know, cool, is that. The game basically shames you for, like, not building Utopia. In a way that is very disconnected from like the rest of the game is like very aware of what it is, and it basically says, "You did all these things, bro, and you wouldn't have done this if it wasn't bad. Why'd you do it?" And it's, and also, and like, I didn't feel any shame or it's hard.
Well, that was
hard
exactly. I didn't eat. Well, I made a point of being quite benevolent. And I never took more power, did, you know, worse things than were absolutely necessary. And the last thing that the game left me with was, but what, you know, we crossed the line. I was like, first of all, I reject that characterization of, like, having a police force and allowing children to gather wood. But,
dude, I built a jail. Like,
right.
It's been happened before, bro. Like, yeah. It's going to happen again. Like, did you think that we weren't going to have jails?
Right. Yeah. And then it's like, but was it worth it? I was like, first of all, yes. And even if I had taken way worse actions than I actually did take, it would have been worth it. I don't know if I ever actually said the word. I just mentioned that these publications that I hate use it. I don't know if I said the word is ludonarrative dissonance. Ludonarrative dissonance, which means the mechanics or the actions, the mechanics of the game or the actions that you take or are encouraged to take as a player cut against the narrative or the kind of, you know, the plot or narrative structure of the game. I never experienced that. I didn't really experience it at any point in the game itself. I think it was quite harmonious. You know, there was ludonarrative harmony, so to speak. Like, everything actually worked really well up until the epilogue tried to shame me for, like, yeah, having a police force and, you know, when people were troublemakers or stealing stuff, you know, punishing them on occasion with physical force.
Yeah, and also, like, there are basically, like, dissidents, right? And you punish dissidents because you're, like, a fascist and a dictator. But it does imply that, like, punishing dissidents is a fascist thing to do.
Right. Yeah.
Where...
Because liberals never punish dissidents, right?
Yeah, like, that's just what you do with dissidents, is you punish them. And, like, you try to find them out, and you punish them. And, like, they're actively trying to... Like, so... The game is, like... In the USSR, there was always this fantasy that there were either fascist or, like, Trotskyite saboteurs in the society trying to subvert it and bring it down. And this game is basically, like... Where there is an explicit, like, saboteur faction that you are uprooting that is trying to sabotage everything. And so you are, like, fully justified in... Your purges, A, are real... Not, like, that strict in terms of the punishments you mete out for these things. Like, in terms of, like, the real world, you could, like... If someone's, like, stealing food, you could just murder them. And the
I mean,
punishment
you imagine
is, like, you just keep them
that's
alive.
That's the thing. Is like you imagine, working. Like, in a setting like this where it's like, okay... Everything's freezing. I mean, the lowest the temperature ever gets is negative 40 degrees centigrade.
That's the
highest. I mean, that's the warmest that it ever... Lowest in the sense of... Anyway, the warmest that it ever gets is negative 40. In the depths of the storm at the end, it's negative 150. Food is a constant
centigrade.
Struggle.
And that's centigrade, not
centigrade,
Fahrenheit.
Yes. Not Fahrenheit.
So that's very fucking cold.
So... Food is a constant struggle. Everything is a constant struggle. Everything, you know, there's a million fires that constantly need to be put out. If someone is stealing, like, getting roughed up by the town watch should be the least of your concerns.
Yes. Well, the lack of a lynching mechanic surprised me, looking back on it.
There is one if you go the theocrat route and you make it...
Oh!
If you go a new yeah. faith, if you get all... If you go full... Sorry, one... I'm gonna turn off recording for 1 second. Yeah. So the very end of the theocrat fascism, theocratic dictator law tech tree is New Faith, which is like, I actually maybe we could take a second to back up for a second and talk a little bit about. So it's clearly. So when I first saw so you get you when the Londoners happens when the Londoner revolt happens, your fate, that's up to that point you only had the adaptation law tree, which is like, you know, things you have to do to survive under these conditions. Then you get this choice that you want to make. Do you want to be a secular dictator or a theocratic dictator? Which is, you know, and I chose to be a theocratic dictator for, you know, LARP. I also sort of genuinely, you know, I mean, it's sort of where my priors are at a certain level.
Yeah,
I mean,
we have different,
exactly.
Yeah, once again, yeah.
But
I was hoping you would have picked it so we would have this.
That was also contrast. Part, I sort of figured that you would. And, yeah. So anyway.
I'm a party man, DK. I'm a party man.
So it's like, okay, well, now I do think under these conditions that, you know, faith is going to be a more effective motivator, and giving people a sense of purpose and is going to, you know, help them get through this situation. So the judging from the description that I saw at the beginning of the laws, it sort of was like very cagey about you know, what specifically obviously it's all kind of a Christian analog, but
I would say it's like Anglican before it was gay, but
yes, very much. Well, so the people, once you start going down that route, the in-game flavor text and some of the dialogue that, you know, including voiced lines that you'll get, reference God. They say like, oh, you know, the Almighty is protecting us, and the captain, that's you, the player, is the voice of God, and they talk about God. They don't talk about Jesus, but they talk about God. The symbol that they use is not a cross; it's some weird kind of. Oh, it actually reminded me of the Warhammer 40K. Thing, it's kind of similar, but anyway, so you go and you basically, like, initially you're sort of like you build a temple, you build two faith houses, and then you build a temple, and it's all very clearly kind of modeled on Christian cathedrals, but then the last choice on the tree, which was just sort of weird to me, and really to me it was more like they don't really get religion, which is fine, I don't expect them to, but it was just sort of funny. Was new faith, where like you, the captain, are essentially like a like you're forming a new religion around yourself. Like you're explicitly now a cult with yourself as its leader, and you're saying like we're not doing the old faith anymore. It's like, well, it's a little, it's not entirely clear whether it's, or maybe it's both, or who knows, but it's like intended to be more like, you know, something like, you know, well, God has a new prophet, and I'm the prophet of like the new, you know, basically you're doing a complete break more or less with the past in continuity at a certain level, but more just like, you know, setting yourself up at not as God, but as like the new prophet. Or
you're doing a John Smith bit. Okay, that makes sense.
Yeah, very much so. Exactly. Yeah. Or like a Muhammad kind of thing. And if you do that, then the game really punishes you in the epilogue. I wanted to see both ways because I didn't need to do that, but I had a similar dramatic moment where like I kind of told myself, well, you know, in the heart of the storm, now is the time to be like, you know, I'm going to take absolute power. You have to have trust in me, citizenry. In the epilogue, they're like, you know, you're not a prophet, but, you know, you did this thing anyway. And it's like, well, how do you know that, game? How do you know that I'm not a prophet? You know what I mean? It was just sort of a funny thing. But more than that, it was like, so the big kind of, so there's a, I presume there's something similar if you make that final step in the, on the secular route, where basically there's a portion of the population that doesn't accept the change, and so they fight you and they die. And then as a result of that, now I never actually did any of this because it was, again, it was like the very last bit of the game, and I never had to do that to impose order, and it's mainly designed to fight the Londoners. But as part of the change, you make an public execution grounds at the generator, and you can execute dissidents for you know, bonuses to hope or removal of discontent. I forget which one it is, if not both.
Wait, do you throw them in the generator?
I never did it. I never had
just applied.
I think so. Yeah.
That's cool.
It is cool. I was like, but yeah, you can execute dissidents for upcomies. That's a thing you can do.
Interesting. So there is like a public execution thing in the order tree as well. I actually don't remember. So the order tree is a little more like, you can do like a Reichstag fire thing, where like you can
where communists burn down the thing, and then you get to.
Yeah, but you can, like, basically trigger an uprising, like, it's called, like, the agitator fucking, like, law, basically, where you just put in, like, a agent provocateur, and it fixes the whole, you know, anti-revolutionary faction. Ties it up pretty easily. I never really had a... I think the Order has a much easier time dealing with the dissidents, because, like, so we have you have people who don't like this. Like, well, I guess I build a jail.
Yeah, and well, that was what I wanted to say. Was the first thing that one of the main reasons why, because it's not the you don't first thing. I actually didn't form the Faith Watchers until I did a bunch of other stuff. And the first thing on the tree is, or at least it's one of the first things, and it was the first thing that I did, and is to build like these faith houses, these like churches essentially, which are good for hope. And you basically like, you put them in range of people's dwellings, and then you call them to prayer, and they raise everybody's hope, and it's really nice. Actually, it was like, oh, this is actually quite wholesome. And then later on, you can make an infirmary, house of healing, it's called, I think, where it's basically like a church-run hospital that isn't effective as the scientist-run hospital, but it's good enough. You know, it helps out. It's definitely a net benefit. So I really emphasized all that kind of thing, and which made it all the weirder in the end, where they were like, you had people doing public violent public penance. I'm like, well, that's what you mean. Like, it was a weird kind of thing of like, what was interesting about that to me also is like, the reason why that's even a meme is because, yeah, in the Middle Ages, you would have people going down the street, you know, in sackcloth and ashes and like whipping themselves, you know, in public penance for their sins. Like, that's a good thing. You know what I mean? Like, there's nothing wrong with that. And that's, like, part of European history. I don't know. It was just kind of a funny kind of tonal disconnect.
Yeah. There's some interesting stuff. There's a similar building within the fascism tree where it's, like, basically a police station. Precinct or a watchtower, and it's the same thing where it's like a no-brainer building where you gain this, you know, these bonuses. It's got a big nice little red banner on it to show that it's further from the bad guys. But it was another similar thing where it's like you enforced, like in the epilogue for the fascists is I think a lot more like bizarre, because it's like you enforced the law to the extreme. It's like, yeah,
yeah, I did.
Yeah, that was. That was the point. Like, you built a jail. Yeah, I did that. Built a jail. Like, you know, it's like, it was basically like the whole thing is just like begging for the yes, Chad. Like, yep, did that. I didn't mind it, because I think it maybe is more jarring if you play the faith tree, but the fascism tree just says, like, you did fascism. And it's like, yeah, I had two options. I could have not done it. And, that also is interesting with the key. I don't think you can not pick one of the trees, right?
I think, well, you don't. There's nothing forcing you to do either, strictly speaking. I don't think. Like, I think you could just only do laws from adaptation and not bother with the other tree. I would have to go back and I want to play another campaign on a harder difficulty setting and be a secular dictator, and maybe I'll get back to you. But yeah,
yeah.
I don't think you are forced to. It's just. Given the Londoner problem, it's kind of you almost have to.
Yeah, because you have to work around them up. You have to deal with them. Yeah. I also remember. Was there like a Londoner event where you can just like kick some out?
There's a couple points where you have the ability to do some stuff like that. Yeah, it's only like a couple at a time, and it doesn't really solve the problem.
I think at one point realized like that. The game makes a big deal when people die, but if they die by not, like, getting the dying effect through, like, a hospital or whatever, it's not that big a deal. So I kind of started just burning people when I realized that labor isn't as scarce as the game makes it out to be, maybe.
Well, especially not once you, you know,
have
once
a big population.
Once you have once a big population, it's like you really, you do have a labor surplus. It's kind of interesting in terms of communist analysis, but,
yeah.
Yeah, once you get like industrial mining facilities, you know, for coal, wood, and steel, you don't really need that much labor.
Yeah. That's one thing about why I really treasure my first playthrough, because there's things you can do that make it like I had like two automated work crews by the time in that playthrough. You can get a lot more than that, obviously. And I think that's kind of why I had so much fun, because even then, I was still pretty over population. And I think that's one of the reasons I had such a great time, is because I didn't have like much automation, and I kind of got into the point towards the end where I was actually had to reintroduce that labor shortage, which was kind of like a solved problem. But to get through that winter, I had to kind of redo the thing where you prioritize, a deprioritize, like, oh, I guess this building is shorthanded for a while I do X, Y, Z.
That's the other, like, it's interesting because it's like you're mechanically captures both the kind of, like, you know, city management under conditions of really extreme crisis in multiple directions, but also like kind of supply line management and industrial process management, where it's like, yeah, you gotta, you know, figure out what percent efficiency you're capable of maintaining an adequate coal supply line on, while, you know, if you don't have enough people to man the coal mine simultaneously with whatever other facilities, you know, need to be run because however many people are sick and or you know, whatever. It definitely is sort of like part of the fires you're putting out is concerns like personnel and supply chain, not just, you know, the other side of things.
Mm-hmm.
Did you have anything else?
Yeah, I don't want to get into like little bits of cheats, but there's a lot of like, I'll just say there's a lot of cool mechanics going on. There's not really any true exploits, really. But there's a lot of like one thing that is, because I don't think it's gonna give it away. You probably should already play the game, but like raw food is more storage efficient than already cooked food. Because
I did not figure that out. Or what do you mean?
Because your cookhouse, so when the winter comes, the big storm comes, you can't grow any more food, but you can cook existing raw food storages.
Oh, I see what you mean. Yeah, that's a good. I just built up as much raw food rations as I could.
Yeah. So you don't need to build any cookhouses as you think to store up, because like the rations, like I think you actually have to get the rations, like hope bonus thing. You have to make them into rations, and to fill that meter. But you don't actually have to fill the meter if you have enough raw food on hand, because cookhouses never stop working because they're heated and stuff. You know, they're a heated facility. Which is fun. Also, I'm going through the wiki. Apparently, so the faith tree seems, I don't know, they're both, I guess they obviously have pluses and minuses, but I didn't even know you could save Londoners. I just thought you'd have fucking they to be dealt with.
Oh, I didn't know that you couldn't. Yeah, I was just sort of, I just, yeah, converted. That was how I resolved the crisis pretty peacefully that way.
Did not. I think towards the end, I think I reduced their numbers through like all the kind of events as naturally as you could, just by keeping my hope high, my discontent low. And then I think towards the end, they like kind of ultimatum, and I said, "All right, well," it was like, "whatever number you guys want to leave, just leave." And I gave them the minimum, like, you have to give them like some like, you can give them like a lot of supplies or a little bit or a middled amount. And I gave them the smallest amount, took a slight debuff that went away very quickly.
Yeah. On that note of there was a point where it seemed excessive, but it was one of those just like nice touches, I guess, where there was a father who went after, who was like his daughter ran away or something. Or got lost. I think it doesn't. Anyway, he wanted to go after her, and he wanted something absurd like 30 full food rations to go with him, and it just makes no sense. I mean, it's sort of like and you're like, dude, she's gone, man. But I was like, whatever, I can spare it at this point. It's fine, you know, whatever. I'm not gonna begrudge him this. Fine, you want to go out on this fool's errand and get yourself killed as well, whatever. And then like in just as the horrible worst part of the storm is starting up, in the middle of like the when it's like, you know, -150, he comes back with her in tow, and the little dialogue pop up box, you know, says miracles do happen, And I was like, oh, this is a nice little... I don't think... I didn't get... Maybe I was already maxed out on whatever it was, but there was no mechanical benefit that I saw, but it was just like a really nice... Because I had forgotten about it at that point, obviously. I mean, I have so many other things going on in my mind. But yeah, I had forgotten about it. And then when I saw them arrive safely, I was like, oh, that's nice. I don't know if I'd be able to do it on a harder playthrough, though.
Yeah. What else? Do you, so there is one very interesting thing about the game is that you can kind of, especially the Londoners campaign is, or the Megaspan campaign, what is it called? Like the, oh, A New Home. Is that you can do certain, like, it, you can do things like late and do like finish quests late to try to trigger the, storm later, and like you can kind of try to do exploits that way. But what's notable is the cycle of the weather will never change. So if you like, there's ways you can do to like pop the storm early, and but that's beneficial because all the story events are happening at a slightly accelerated rate. So you're dealing with like say the Londoners or the refugees when the temperature is warmer. And therefore, it's easier. So there are like there are things you can do, and you could push this. You can also like not do certain story things and pop the storm later, which in theory gives you more time to get gear up for it. But it keeps getting colder anyway. So the first time, one reason I think I had such a hard time is that I kind of had figured those out. Like on my first playthrough, they're kind of obvious. That hey, I just don't finish this quest, or I wait as long as I can before finishing it. And I popped the storm really late, but even like the weeks before the storm were miserable because the cold was still hitting. Even if the storm
I had a similar. I was just taking as much time to prepare as I could, just generally, and I delayed it basically as much as possible. And it's comparatively rare, I think, that in terms of difficulty spikes, that like you know typically you get a fairly gentle curve and then a spike, and then often with these kinds of just really games generally you'll once you reach a certain point where you have enough buffs and enough abilities etc, you'll just a declining difficulty curve right through to the end game, and then maybe there's a spike at the final boss maybe. There was actually a quite organic natural second difficulty spike after like a kind of plateau and gentle decline once I started getting things sorted out that I only really overcame immediately before the storm, which then I guess just because I managed to optimize things enough, it didn't actually end up presenting a difficulty spike per se, although it could have if I you know had not had every, but yeah it was I would say it's even well designed in that regard as well. And yeah, it's an interesting. I didn't realize. I mean, I guess it makes sense, but I to me it was just sort of like I don't know if I it was entirely conscious, but I was like, yeah, I definitely want to take. I'm not going to prioritize like moving the narrative along because I know that's going to come with additional challenges. I want to try to focus on getting everything where I want it to be first. But I could see that that might actually make it harder in certain ways.
Yeah, it definitely makes it colder and the cold. And cold really the game does cold very well.
Yeah, there's a cool you know. Like overlay even where I mean you can see visually with a literal heat map like you know which buildings are what temperature and where's struggling and it's just yeah it's just it really gives you this feeling of what the game's representing. Maybe I don't have to say it again, but yeah it's really engrossing in a very good way, and I really can't highly recommend it enough. I was surprised at how much I liked it. I'd heard good things, but I'm just amazed that this was able to get made.
I don't know if there can ever be a sequel to this thing or how you would even do it. It's very much as close to a perfect tight thing.
One off, yeah.
That you can. You're gonna see. What was the studio that did this? I guess we give them the 11-bit
Studios, which has a couple other. What else did they do? They did a few. They did one or two other titles that I'm familiar with. They did This War of Mine. That's right.
Oh wow, that's also a really good. also a profoundly white game.
Yeah, but we could do an episode on that. I wouldn't mind.
Probably
that.
Have you played it? You've played it, right?
I haven't. No, I have it in my Steam. Ooh. I got it on the Humble Bundle or something. I haven't played it.
It's a very similar, like, tone. Off, actually, probably hopelesser, I guess you would call it. It's much less forgiving.
Anyway, yeah. So we could do we could do something on that, and they have.
I wonder. Yeah. I guess we'll look into them. I wonder if they're like in Europe or something like that.
They must be,
and that's and insulated because like they're
war. Guess.
Warsaw.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you heard war. I was like, ah.
Yeah. Yep. Based Poland. Yes. Anyway, yeah. So.
More like 14-bit. Am I right? Hey.
Oh man, yeah. I guess that. I mean, they're yeah disconnected enough for now from
global. So I'm not too familiar with the Polish games industry, but from what I hear, what they all do, like the big thing there is that like out of college or whatever equivalent, like early kind of cert you get, you go work for peanuts for CD Projekt Red for like a few years. It's basically like getting your master's degree in Polish video game design. So you work there, they work you to death, you know, for a few years till you burn out, and then you go and join some smaller studio or start your own one, and that's kind of the cycle, like the life cycle of being a video game developer in Poland.
I mean, it's not the worst system, you know.
Yeah. So I'm sure they're probably ex CD Projekt Red guys, if I had to guess, because everybody over there seems to be.
Seems to be, yeah.
And I can see that maybe that's why the writing's always so good. One of those CD Projekt writers, because it really is a good game, and it has that Anglophilia that Poles often.
Thought it was an English studio. It's so Anglo. I thought it was an English studio.
Well, the most Anglo book ever written was written by a Pole, you know.
Which you mean,
Heart of Darkness?
Yeah.
So.
Yep. Yeah.
I guess we should wrap it up there.
I think that's a good place. Yeah, that's as always, we maybe might revisit in the future or as part of some other thing. Yeah,
it's also on consoles, not just PC.
I was wondering that. I was like, I vaguely remember seeing it on consoles. Like, I don't even know how that would work. It seems so mouse and in particular mouse
it's
dependent.
It's just mouse, but you can just cursor around. Imagine.
I guess. I mean.
I don't know, but it looks yeah. So
anyway, we sent out notifications on post when it was free, and hopefully you picked it up. If you didn't, it's get it on sale, unless you're if you've listened to all this despite our warnings. I still think it's definitely worth playing, but more than that, it prompted me yet again to sort of reflect on what even are video games? What even is a video game? And or does the term video game even how useful of a term is that? I prefer these days. I mean, it's not that it's a bad word exactly. I prefer to think in terms of interactive media, or whatever computer-dependent interactive media, something like that. Because it's not... I mean, when you think about a game, like, when you start with a video game, like, you're talking about, Galaga, right? Or maybe some early arcade games, Pong, or maybe some, kind of early... And yeah, I mean, you can draw a line from that to, like, something like, late 80s, early 90s classics and RPGs and stuff. But I think even by that time, to compare, like, let's say Baldur's Gate to, like, Pong, because Pong or Galaga or some simpler action games, even Mario, I think it's fair to call Mario a game, much like, chess or football or whatever, however you want to find game. I think you could put Mario and some of these earlier simpler titles in that category. When you're talking about Frostpunk, and it's not the only example of this, but I think it's a really good one, and I'm very, very glad that you suggested this, and that I had a chance to experience this. I think it's much more like reading a book, but like most books suck, and this doesn't suck. You know, this question of like, you know, games or art was raging for a while, and I always thought it was a kind of a stupid debate, because it's like there's games that are art and the games that are aren't, or that are games that are trying to, you know, set for themselves a higher bar, whether or not they clear it, and games that are clearly just about, you know, having a good time in whatever way. And this is an experience. This Frostpunk is an experience. It is telling not just a story. It's not just telling you a story. It's making you live out a story and creating something in your mind, even in your body, for you viscerally as an experience, and getting you to think about all kinds of questions, and getting you to engage with really deep questions of I'm not even going to like qualify that. It's a work of political philosophy more than, quote, a video game. And that's pretty rare. That's pretty rare. I mentioned this before one time on a previous episode. The game that's come the closest in my experience to a kind of thing was Brothers, A Tale of Two Sons, where, you know, spoilers, but it does something mechanically very similar, where it trains your body to interact with the medium in a certain way. You have certain kinds of like physical expectations, and then it rips them away in the most visceral, horrifying way possible, to the point where you feel like you're missing an arm, is how I experienced it, kind of first person subjectively. It was like all of a sudden, it's like my arm doesn't work, which is not an experience I had ever had prior to that. And this comes the closest, and it was very different. Kind of, that's a much more kind of intimate story of, you know, two brothers. This is a, you know, grander scale. It's still pretty small, but it's, you know, it's a city, a small city, and yeah, it's a work of political philosophy that is just the text is not written on dead trees. It's not written in words. It's written in bytes of code and in you know, art design and in sound design that leads you to have a certain kind of visceral experience. So yeah, definitely, just really, really great. And I think that's pretty much all I had to say in conclusion. Did you have anything else?
In terms of the game, it's a, you know, 100% play it. It's probably my, I guess if we do like a retroactive game of the year, it was my game of the year for, it came out in 2019. There's nothing came out this year that can top it. And I, you know, I'm very excited to see what 11-bit does in the future.
Yeah.
I think they have a, I don't want to say they don't have an aesthetic, but they have a tone and a history of executing well on limited visions that is kind of unique in the genre, in the, well, not the genre, like the industry.
They're an example of I think we're starting to see, who knows if it'll last or not, but there's, because there was that first rush of indie, quote, indie games, that some of them were good, some of them weren't, in like, you know, the early 2010s, and now you're seeing, and then for a while it was just kind of dead, but now we're starting to see, looks like, this emergence of kind of like a double A.
The same thing. They're a double A studio is probably the way to put it.
And that's where there's some really cool work happening in that space. So, and this is, you know, prime example of it. Anyway, I think that's enough for now, but hope you all have enjoyed. If you have any other questions or recommendations, you know, always feel free to reach out. We have some new subscribers, so thank you very much to all of you. And you know, we take every little bit of that as just a, you know, an encouragement to keep doing what we're doing. And I think, you know, this is a great, you know, if video games are the preferred medium of especially men under 50, but really just, you know, where most of the interesting stuff is happening, because books are dead, you know, especially fiction is just completely garbage. There's nothing happening in fiction, and TVs, movies, not a whole lot better, especially these days. Electronic entertainment media is kind of where the cool stuff is happening, to the extent that there is anything cool happening and we are very happy to analyze it and discuss it. So with that, stay safe, everybody. And, you know, watch out for the cold, and take care.
Dumb. Girls are dumb.